This message was recorded at the 2005 Christian Home Educators of Colorado Conference in Denver, Colorado, held June 9th, 10th, and 11th, 2005. To find out more about CHEC, please visit the CHEC website at www.chec.org or call the CHEC office at 720-842-4852. To order additional messages from this conference, please visit www.bestchristianconferences.com.
Father, thank you that we have the privilege, potentially, of training our kids for very deep and significant ministry in your kingdom. We desire, Father, that your kingdom would come and your will would be done here on earth as it is being done in heaven. May the time that we spend even in this hour prepare us to prepare our kids and us to fulfill your purposes in the world. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. As Robin said, I am John Holtzman. My wife and I started our company about 15 years ago, within months after we had started homeschooling ourselves. And the reason that we started the company was because of this unique experience that my wife and a friend had on an ongoing basis. We lived in a missions community in Southern California. It was called the U.S. Center for World Mission. Actually, it is still called the U.S. Center for World Mission. We don't live there anymore, obviously. But our entire neighborhood was composed of people who homeschooled. And my wife and a friend across the back fence would be talking with neighbors, and the neighbors would they'd get talking, you know, how's homeschooling going? And the neighbors would burst into tears. Oh, it is so hard. We're having such a hard time. And Sarita and Becky would look at each other in wonderment. How can this be? We are having such a great time. Over the course of the months, and this is kind of when we were first beginning to homeschool, Sarita is my wife, Becky is the neighbor, they started to realize, you know, it must be the method that we're using. We're using what we're calling today a literature-rich method of teaching our kids. And we are having a good time, and we need to share this with other people. Becky had served as a missionary in Morocco for many years, and she said to my wife one day, you know, if you think it's tough homeschooling here, if you think it's tough to find good materials here in the United States, you ought to be over there. You know, you get these magazines, and they tout these wonderful materials that they have to sell, and you get them, you spend all this money, and you go, oh no, it's not what I really wanted. And but you're stuck using it anyway. What we should do is put together the best of the best and make it available to missionaries. That's the way we began our company and how we became more and more focused on this literature-rich approach to homeschooling. We found that people in other countries had difficulty finding good materials, as I've already mentioned. They don't have access to all the media that we have here in the United States that a lot of kids spend a lot of time doing. So what could we do that would kind of kill two birds with one stone, both educate and entertain at the same time, where the kid who really doesn't have much else to do with his life might actually say, you know, could I read that book that I was assigned for school? Could I do that just before I go to bed, just for fun? And so that's the way we began, and amazingly, it seemed to work, and we enjoy sharing this opportunity with other people. So that's why I'm here. Literature-rich homeschooling. What does it mean? How does it compare with other materials? By the way, I guess you all were given a kind of an outline. I have to confess, I have never done this before in my life, but there's always a first time. So hopefully I kind of allow you to fill in the blanks. I left lots of blanks because I didn't know what I was really going to say today. No, I have a vague idea, but where I go and what specifically I say, I don't know. So I don't want to be like some of those pastors who have the line, you know, and the specific word. No way. So anyway, enjoy. Hopefully you can hang on for the ride. It seems to us, as we've looked at the general homeschool marketplace, that probably the most popular method. And by popular, I guess I should say the one that's used by the most people. It's not necessarily the one that people love the most, but the one that most people use is textbooks. We're all familiar with them from school. Most of us were raised in classroom schools, and they use textbooks. What's another method? Lectures, videos, where people, a talking head kind of presents the material. I'm just going to outline here where I'm going, and then we'll start filling in some blanks. Computer-based education, plop your kid in front of the computer and interact with the computer, answer the questions, and you'll be educated. When we first started homeschooling, there were a couple of programs that were very well known in the homeschool marketplace. I'm not sure why they seem to have kind of faded a little bit. Actually, I have some theories, but they are still around as far as I know. These would be mostly hands-on or activity-based education, where you do a lot of craftsy things. Great fun for the kids. And then there's these are all the ones that I could think of. And then there's the literature-based approach, which instead of textbooks, uses trade books or the books that you'd find in a regular bookstore. And amongst those, the ones that I think of, there'd be historical fiction. Here I've got Johnny Tremaine, which we use in third grade when we're doing American history. Biographies, Meet George Washington, Lincoln, a photobiography. Oh, Peter the Great. These books come in all varieties. Here, can you imagine a biography with full-color pictures all the way through? Beautiful. The photobiography, of course, is photographs in black and white. Many biographies, however, are just plain text. So anyway, biographies, books that I call discovery books. Many of you are familiar with the Usborne line. There's also Dorling Kindersley. For those of you who are unfamiliar with them, just take a little look here. The way I characterize these, it's almost like having the opportunity to learn history or science by looking at the photographs of National Geographic and just reading the captions underneath. I mean, it's so engrossing. Little kids, we hear this all the time. You know, my second grade son took his world history book to bed. He put it under his pillow. He likes to sleep on it. If he can get the flashlight, he's out there reading his world history book at night. We like little stories like that. Fiction books. Here's Sarah Plain and Tall. I think we use this like in second grade. The 100 Dresses is another book. We'll actually return to these later this afternoon. And then nonfiction works. Standard nonfiction books that you'd get, again, in a regular bookstore. The 100 Most Important Events in Christian History. Story of Christianity. These ones we happen to use in, I think, around the ninth grade level, high school level. Actually, our Kingdom History or Church History by another name program is valid for anything in the high school realm. But again, this happens to be, this is a Dorling Kindersley book. It's not quite as fully illustrated as many Dorling Kindersleys. It has quite a bit more text because it is a full-blown history book for adults, but you can see it's a gorgeous book. So that's what it's using, these kinds of books that have to fight for your dollars on a regular bookstore shelf that we prefer to use for educating our kids. So how do these methods compare? Let me summarize everything I'm going to say today in just a couple of illustrations. I feel like these things say pretty much everything I'm going to say, but not in detail. The first image I'd like you to keep in mind, because I think this is true, we've seen it in our own lives, is literature-rich education is you, or, you know, it's wonderful seeing so many guys here. Used to be always only women, but anyway, you, male or female, or your spouse, sitting on the couch, cuddling with your kids. That's literature-rich education. You know, 2 years ago, our youngest son, who is 18 now, he's heading off to college, But at 16 years old, middle of the summer, my wife said, you know, why don't you guys read a book together? And there was no hesitation. He's a big kid. adult. You know, he wants to be independent. He said, yeah, let's do that. So there we sat on the couch. And we didn't just sit, you know, I wasn't on one end and he's on the other. We're sitting right there, shoulder to shoulder, leaning into each other, touching for an hour at a time at that age, and my age. There's a closeness there, even at the later stages. There's that, or honestly, my general impression of pretty much all the other methods, go educate yourself. As little contact as possible, thank you. That's one image. The other image is the one that I started this with. It's so hard. Or, man, are we having a blast? I get more letters. Well, more than what? I get a lot of letters from people women who have bachelor's, master's, PhDs. They're saying, you know what? I am learning more, even in the kindergarten, than I learned all the way through school. And we get these kinds of stories all the time from people. They're just so excited to be learning with their kids. So it's a with or a part. And that's, if I were to summarize everything I'm going to say here today, that's the way I'd summarize it. Well, let's look at textbooks. You know, I should probably bring some up, but I think you know what they look like. What are some advantages of textbooks? Well, they have lots of information in them, and they're pretty compact, though it's amazing how textbooks seem so big and heavy. They use even heavy paper, and so you got this book, and you're kaplunk. But they have lots of information. That's good. They have good credentials usually, you know, so-and-so PhD or so-and-so Master of Education or somebody wrote this book or was an editor or contributed to it. So they have credentials. They're usually reviewed by a committee someplace. Hopefully then you could trust them. At least you'd expect them to be accurate because they've been reviewed. They have the trappings of a classroom school built right in. You got quizzes at the end of the chapter, glossary, all those special aids that teachers love. And honestly, many of us think that are required in order to make sure your kid is well educated. Another advantage, potentially, especially if you have a lot of kids, they're hard bound. So they should last a long time. I guess, well, at least not all of them are hard bound. Some of them aren't, but many of them are. And why would that be? Because they don't want to be falling apart after some kids are abusing them. Why might they abuse them? What are some problems with textbooks? The biggest thing that I see is that they lack virtually everything that makes something interesting and memorable. Rarely do they tell the whole story. They have no emotion. They have no context. Have no conflict. That's the biggest thing that a story is all about. That's what plot is all about. This person is he going to make it or is he not? It's all summarized for you right there. So it's boring. There's no drama. Let me use an illustration here. One well-known homeschool textbook publisher, History of the World in Christian Perspective. American Revolutionary War is summarized in 7 paragraphs. Lots of information in a brief space. And here are the first three of the 4 paragraphs. The Shot Heard Round the World. So there's a title. On the morning of April 19, 1775, the first shots of the War for Independence, sometimes called the Revolutionary War, were fired at Lexington, Massachusetts. It is not known for sure who fired the first shot, but it was a shot heard round the world, for it was to change the course of human history. After killing 8 Americans and wounding 10 others at Lexington, the British marched on to Concord, destroying the military supplies stored there. The Battle of Lexington and Concord was not quite over, however. As the British troops headed back to Boston, Patriots fired on them from behind trees, shrubs, and barns. Although 93 Americans died that day, the British lost 273 men. For a brief moment in history, little Massachusetts stood alone against one of the great empires of the world. The Second Continental Congress, there's the next subhead. Less than a month after the Battle of Lexington and Concord on May 10th, 1775, the Second Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia. John Hancock was elected president. The assembled representatives of the American people decided emphatically that they would fight. The Continental Army was established. A call was issued to the colonies to raise troops and funds, and George Washington, 1732 to 1799, who had distinguished himself as a lieutenant colonel in the French and Indian War, was appointed commander-in-chief. There's the three paragraphs. Four paragraphs then continue to tell the rest of the story, and the last of these seven paragraphs concludes in 1781, 5 years after the Declaration of Independence, the last major battle of the War for Independence was over, an American victory, a British surrender. That was actually crisp, well-written prose. Got an awful lot of information in there. If you can take notes, hopefully you'll memorize it all so you can regurgitate it in your test. What is the significance of this? John Hancock was elected president. I've gone through this several times, so I remember. John Hancock was elected president. Who is John Hancock? He was the president of the Continental Congress. Bell, he wins. But who cares? I mean, really, well, he has a beautiful signature. I do remember that. There is this insurance company called John Hancock. I don't really know, and I honestly, I hate to say it, but I don't really care. It's a story, but wow. It's just a summary of this story. World Studies for Christian Schools, the other major publisher of textbooks. Seven paragraphs for World War II. Five paragraphs set the stage, explain the Nazis' rise to power, and then, slowly, the Russians began to turn back the Nazi forces in the east. In the west, the United States and Britain began to chip away at the Axis Empire. They landed in North Africa in 1942, then in Sicily in 1943, and then on the mainland of Italy 2 months later. Finally, on June 6, 1944, known as D-Day, a huge Allied force landed in France and shattered Germany's defenses. Like a vice, the Allied forces crushed the Axis nations between them. Italian rebels shot Mussolini and hung his body up in a gas station. Hitler shot himself in his bunker under the ruins of Berlin rather than surrender. On May 8, 1945, the war in Europe ended. Again, crisp, precise writing, more active verbs, which I appreciate. You at least know who is doing what. In the other book, it was so-and-so was elected and things were done. At least here, people are, you know who is doing what. but you know, it's like a fire hose, in my opinion. Let's take another approach. I would like to use a novel. Now, wait a second. One novel for the Revolutionary War. Actually, we probably have three or four books. Actually, I know we have three or four or five or six books that we cover. That's an awful lot of reading. But you know, I would rather read something that really entertains me, that I, Mom, keep reading. Don't stop. I mean, it's okay. Well, you know, we have to eat lunch. I get these stories too. Please, Mom, we really want you to keep on reading. And Mom says, come on, we got to eat lunch. My voice is getting tired. But please, tell you what, if you guys will make the lunch, then I'll keep reading. Okay, anything. I mean, the kids, they're feeling compelled by their school. Although no townsmen except only the doctors were permitted on the wharf, Johnny knew that hundreds of them stood well back and in darkness gloating. This, by the way, this is at the end of the Lexington-Concord battle. Okay, so it's the same basic event, but it's at the tail end. Johnny knew that hundreds of them stood well back and in darkness gloating. They were not saying much, only watching. Then one man began to whistle. The next took it up, and the next, and the next. The whistling was shrill as a fife. They had not forgotten the prophecy of that morning. Yeah, they go out by Yankee Doodle, but they'll dance to it before nightfall. Yankee Doodle filled the darkness as the eerie shrilling of the hylas filled black swamps in spring. Four more boats were coming in. Johnny dared move out onto the wharf, but he still kept well in shadow. More wounded. By the way, they're watching the British come back. Could these be the very men who had started out so confidently? Bedraggled, dirty, torn uniforms, torn flesh, lost equipment, faces ghastly with fatigue and pain. Some were twisting and crying out. The first two boats were filled with privates. They'd been packed in and now were being tossed ashore like so much cordwood. Most of them were pathetically good and patient. But he saw an officer strike a man who was screaming. Johnny's hands clenched. "It is just as James Otis said," he thought. "We're fighting partly for just that. Because a man as a private is no reason he should be treated like cordwood." Emotion? Drama? Interest? Hey, I'll read books like this all day. For days on end. Compared with, "Please, Mom, don't make me read that textbook." That's a comparison that I see. Textbooks, what's another disadvantage? High priced? Honestly, you know, despite the committees, there's no guarantee of accuracy, and maybe you've seen those studies. You know, every year there are these talks about how these committees find all kinds of errors in textbooks. Another aspect, these textbooks, partially because they have been modified by committee, they tend, not only is all the drama taken out and all the conflict taken out of the story, but in a way, they become so bland, you never really realize what the conflict was all about, so you don't know. How do I explain this? I was teaching kingdom history, church history, to my kids, 8th grade. And because we are allowed to have differing books, we get the conflict between the authors. One of them says one thing, and the other one says the other. And my daughter, who had been brought up in Sunday school and church, knew all the answers, all the right answers, but the books presented these converse opinions so strongly, she said, "But Dad, what's the truth?" Suddenly it mattered. She cared. She had passion about this thing, which, you know, 2 hours before she would have sat there being bored. "Oh, yeah, I've heard it all before." Suddenly, "Well, wait a second. They both sound right. What's the truth?" Textbooks, they've taken out all that conflict. You never see it. So your kids, speaking for myself, I didn't really care. It was only when I got to see the other side presented powerfully that I started really wondering to myself and starting to work it through and starting to ask questions and seek people who might know a little bit more than I did. Well, let's move on. Video lectures. Advantages. You don't need to know the subject matter. That is wonderful. I will say, if you're teaching math or something like that, that's probably a great benefit. If you don't have a live person that you can kind of cooperate with. Definitely saves you time. Definitely more engaging than most textbooks. I was trying to think through what are the real disadvantages of that. Well, again, my perspective, go over there and watch your videos. I've got other things to do, which tends to separate you from your kids. It limits where you can do this, because they have to be sitting in front of the TV. If you are on a trip or something like that, most people don't have the videos in their cars or they're not going to haul this stuff around with them. Whereas books, "Hey, Mom, would you keep reading Johnny Tremaine while we're driving out to the coast or whatever we're going to do for vacation?" I mean, this kind of stuff happens all the time. I don't know. I don't need to probably hit too hard on that. Computer-based education, advantages. You don't need any patience. If your kid keeps asking the same question over and over, you won't hear it. With things like math, you know, it's endlessly repetitive as long as he needs it or she needs it, and they'll keep on going. So it's completely self-paced. If they can whip through it, they'll be done. Again, the disadvantage is it's relatively mindless. I've had people who are educated this way say, I learned how to, I think the term is goose, how to goose the test there. I didn't even understand this stuff, but I knew how, you know, you just click on it until you get the right answer and, okay, be done with it. I'm just doing this to do it so I can get it out of the way. It's not because I care. I really don't care about that. It's soulless, isolationist. Again, off there. Unemotional. Can I say it's dehumanizing? Potentially bad for the eyes or perhaps for other parts of your body, although I have to confess I sit in front of the computer screen an awful lot during the day, so maybe I'm being irradiated. Strangely, I was shocked at this. In Marie Wynne's The Plug-In Drug, which apparently must have some new, this must be a newer edition. It was published 2002, and I remember preaching a sermon that I referred to this, must have been an earlier version of this back in the late 80s. At that time, the plug-in drug was TV, and now she's talking about computers. In the latest National Assessment of Educational Progress math assessment, students who spent more time on computers in school didn't score any higher than their peers. In fact, their performance was slightly worse. That flabbergasts me, but that's what she says. That was 2002. My biggest complaint, and it, again, this is that basic point here. Lost opportunities with you. Snuggling or go over there, do your schooling. Crying together, talking through particularly poignant scenes in a gripping novel, or listlessly clicking. Yes, no, C, O, B,
E.
Oh, yeah, all right. Having your kids learn through years of experience with you that you're the source to go to learn about life, to counsel, to find out, well, what should I do in this circumstance, Mom? How should I deal with this friend? Or, man, they're not interested in me. Let me go off and find my other friends. Hands-on activity-based education. You know, I have to confess this is very attractive to me. It is, I like craftsy stuff. The problem is, I don't have time for it. And that's probably our biggest frustration. Lots of fun activities. It appeals wonderfully to the kinesthetic learner, the activity-based learner. I've got to do it if I'm going to understand it. So it does appeal. It's more memorable, usually, if you've got a physical object there. That, too, encourages interaction with your kids, so that's a strength that it has that the other methods do not. The disadvantages, truly, it takes hours to teach, or at least, quote, teach, what could be taught in a few minutes. Sarita told me, this was kind of the last straw that told her, no, I do not want to use activity-based education. She went to an evening meeting, and this woman was teaching them how to put together a mobile. And I think it had to do with the systems of the body. Well, they spent an hour and a half putting together this mobile with all these colorful pieces and the names of the parts of the body on it. And my wife is going, okay, so now we got the names of the body, names of the parts of the body. In an hour and a half, I could have just read the list. If we wanted them to memorize them, we could have probably done that. We could have made a picture and be done. But well, we got this beautiful mobile. Requires tons of parental time and involvement. And I guess you yourself had better really love to do this stuff. Interesting to me, we have found, and we hear this from so many people who follow the literature-rich approach, they've read a book. By the way, when you've read a book like Johnny Tremaine or so many, you've got the image in your mind. It's as though you were there. You didn't see the physical object, so it's not in that sense, but it's so deeply ingrained. And what we find is, just like if you've ever moved, you probably remember how, and you had kids at the time, if you had a big cardboard box, They made a truck, a car, a house. I mean, they build stuff out of this stuff. And they do it on their own. And you didn't have to go out and tell them, now go build a truck. I mean, they just do it naturally. And that's the stuff that we hear all the time. That the mom has read the story, and now daughter goes out. We have climbing Mount Everest with Hillary. You know, he was the first guy with Tenzing who summited Mount Everest back in the 50s. And out behind their house, they were doing some work and on a garage. They were building a garage, so there was this mound of dirt. So the daughter had found a... Well, you know what's strange to me? It wasn't until about 10 years ago that I first really started reading books from a Southern perspective. I had never heard the other side. And as somebody once asked me after I'd read it and I started talking about, well, you know, this is the way they view it. Somebody said, I never understood why would anybody in their right mind ever fight for that other side? It's so wicked. Well, it's when you started to hear the way they were taught, the culture, and you start to think about it in the context of that time, and you find out that even black slaves fought on that side willingly because this is my country. I'm fighting for my country. You start to think about things in a new and different way. Would I have opposed? Whoa, what if I'm living in society today and my society teaches me certain things about abortion or about capitalism or socialism? How am I going to respond to those kinds of things? All of a sudden it becomes far more real in life. Because now you're reading it from different perspectives. You learn how to think with critical questions about the different perspectives. Again, this conflict produces excitement, interest. So, Dad, who's right? Better, more thorough understanding. It's enjoyable, as I suggested earlier. Now you're presenting your information in a way that the kid wants to bring it to bed at night or keep reading. You know, don't stop. One of my favorite photographs that I've ever gotten from one of our customers, this woman said it was the middle of August. The kids had not had school for many weeks or months, and I woke up this morning at 7:30, the kids started marching around the house. They had built placards, protest placards. Do school now! Do school now! And then a seven or eight-year-old and her six-year-old sister and the two-year-old with his diapers dragging behind were all, do school now! Do school now! They just, you know, so what could she do? Not today. But they protested so loudly and vociferously that she finally acquiesced, and next Monday we will begin. Okay, again, it's way more efficient, I think, than the hands-on or activity-based approach, because you're getting the information out there, you're enjoying it, and your kids can enjoy the activities that they're going to create on their own. Again, provides multiple perspectives, argued intensely, encourages critical thinking, as I said. You know, one of the interesting things is, too, here you got four books all about the Civil War. You're reading them at the same time. You're reading George Washington's biography, Johnny Tremaine, Phoebe the Spy, which is another book about a girl who interacts with George Washington. Suddenly, now you're starting to hear place names repeatedly. Excuse me. You hear places, people, events. You you get it from another side, and suddenly the child goes, hey, wait a second, we read about that 2 weeks ago. And there's recognition, and now there's understanding, further understanding that they wouldn't have had before. Again, memory. It encourages you to interact with your kids. As I said, in high school even, I am astonished as a homeschooling dad who has been involved with my kids, I am not astonished at all. I'm very pleased that our kids come to us all the time. My 26-year-old daughter is comfortable coming to me. My 21-year-old daughter, my 22-year-old son, we talk on a regular basis about issues that are concerning them. I look around at the other parents of other kids, and their kids aren't coming to them for counsel. So I think that by having that interaction, by sharing those moments, those significant moments, we build relationship that will stand us in good stead and our kids in good stead with us over the years to come. Something else, when you have conflict, you model to your kids your own inquisitive nature or your own scholarship. So they get to follow the way you do things. So they say, what does that word mean? Oh, let's look it up. And when they're really young, you look it up with them or for them, and you show that again, that inquisitive nature in your own mind. By reading aloud, you can teach a broad range of kids with one book. Now, this is a fascinating thing. If you have a textbook, they're normally normed for a particular age range. And so a fifth grade textbook is really inappropriate for a ninth grade student or maybe even for a seventh grader, and definitely for a third grader. Well, you take Johnny Tremaine that I was just reading. We have that at the third grade level. But we're reading it to our kids. And kids down to kindergarten, they'll miss half the vocabulary, but there's an intensity of the story. You know, if you're sitting at the dinner table, I remember when I was a kid, we'd go visit my grandma and grandpa, and this was during the Vietnam War era, and grandma and grandpa and my parents would be talking rather heatedly about what was going on around the world, and I didn't really know half of what they were talking about, but yet I was fascinated to listen, and I'd catch enough to keep me going. Well, same thing with these kinds of books. The ones who are older, they'll ask you questions, you'll interact with them, and they'll gain, of course, more depth. But the younger ones, too, enjoy the story. And what's interesting is, if you do this, say, as I said, we kind of schedule it around the third grade level, but say you said, we're going to do American history in fifth grade. That's fine. So you do it with your, what's fifth grade, about 10-year-old, 11-year-old, child. But now you have your 8-year-old and your 6-year-old as well. And all three of them will be sitting there together. Well, the 6-year-old, when he or she gets to be about 9 or something like that, maybe you decide you're going to do American history again just with him or her. Well, he won't remember exactly, he won't remember most of what was in that book. Like, oh yeah, that was a great book. At least there's a positive aspect to it. And there will be something that comes along. Go, oh, yes, ooh, 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 this is a good time. This is a great story here. Oh, come on, Mom, keep going. Don't stop now. Kids understand far more words. They understand far more words than they are able to read, right? So that's why you don't need the normed reading level. You are able to explain concepts and provide background information that they wouldn't know about. It was interesting to me, one of our young workers who was not homeschooled more than for 1 year, he came in and we were doing some book with the Depression era in the United States, and it talked about the CCC. What was that? The Civilian Conservation Corps. It would have come to me, but thank you very much. He had never even heard of it. Well, you're reading a book, and you come across CCC, and maybe you know that information, like I pretty well know, or maybe you don't, or maybe you pretty well know it, but you want to know more. So then you go and you pursue it further, and you explain it to your kids. You're able to do that. You're able to correct faulty assumptions, incorrect impressions that they might otherwise have. By accompanying them on your literary adventure, you can help guide their emotional response. Some kids will get really upset or teary-eyed over something. And, you know, it's like, oh, I can't take this anymore. And then And then you kind of work them through. I remember when we were up at Winter Park, the Alpine Slide, one of our sons, go nameless, he didn't like going down that slide very much, you know. And this was as a teenager. So he held the brakes on full and, you know, going on down. Well, if he'd been a little younger, I would have put him in my lap. I would have held him, and we would have gone down at probably a more normal pace. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that you're doing with them when you accompany them through the literature. You can help provide the comfort and the aid that they need as you're going through a particularly emotional passage. You can teach your unique values. This is a tough one for me. I'm afraid to bring it up, but I think it's important that we do. And the reason I'm afraid to bring it up is because if I say some things, these are gut level issues with a lot of people. And if I mention the other side, some of you are going to almost want to, you know, beat me up or something. But this one probably will go over well. Maybe you're a deep-seated pacifist. And the fact that the United States is at war anywhere in the world really bothers you. Well, if you're of that persuasion, you can teach your kids that. And you're along, even as you're reading a Johnny Tremaine or anything about the American Revolution or Civil War or about what we did in the Philippines in the turn of the century, you can talk with your kids about why you feel the way you do about America's involvement in these foreign wars. On the other hand, if you feel strongly that, you know, what we are doing is right, well, then you can teach them that way too. And you can teach them with power and conviction because that's what you believe. And these textbooks or these other books that are out there, they're not going to do that for you or for your kids. Big one, Old Earth, Young Earth. That one I can probably get away with, at least just mentioning it. You all are well familiar with that. Concern for the poor. Some of us might view certain people's concern for the poor as a form of socialism. Some of us would like to be hardcore capitalists and feel that the best thing you can do for the poor is let them work their way through in a pure capitalistic society. Anyway, these are the kinds of things that we can present to our children and that we can do very well because we're present with them. Excuse me, I've got a lot of allergies right now, so it's trying to survive here. You can use the same materials over and over. This is a great one for a lot of women. They are the primary teachers in most homes, and they're deeply involved with their kids. Husbands, not only, forget the homeschool aspect to it, just in terms of life. I will confess for myself, I tend to stay, I get involved to a little degree, but I tend to be more sequestered on my own. I stay away. I couldn't help myself. A lot of husbands, they can't help themselves. Secret, Mom, if this is your situation, hold off on some of those books until your husband is at home and he's nearby and you start reading those books. And this has happened more often than I can tell you, but the husband pretty soon he's kind of creeping in, he's listening in, and then he says, can I listen too? And then he sits down, and then well, what if I were to read to the kids? It's a great way to get your husband involved, not only in their education, but, excuse me, in your kids' lives. What are some of the disadvantages and potential disadvantages of literature rich? It does require significant time with your kids. You got to commit to it. Now, I guess I should say, you don't have to be whole hog literature rich. You could decide, okay, this area I'm going to pursue a literature rich approach, but I'm going to use some other methods as well. And I'm not here to judge about that. I'm just saying, though, that if you do use literature and pursue the path that I'm suggesting, you will be involved. You will spend time. Or, you know what? You're not spending time. You're investing time. And great are the rewards. Skip some things. Oh, this one is a big one. I think a lot of people are afraid. You know, other options may be only mediocre, but man, if I do this wrong, I could totally fail. I could mess up my kid's life. I don't want to risk it. I'd like to suggest that that's highly, highly unlikely. You're involved enough with your kids. Again, you're interacting with them. You know whether they're picking stuff up, and you will be amazed because you're going, wow, they know stuff I've never heard before. I'm learning this for the first time, and they know it in kindergarten, second grade. Why was I so cheated? Again, I've heard this more often. But, you know, people worry about, well, they're going to go in sometime. Some of us are homeschoolers till whenever. I mean, till they graduate or something. And some of us are saying, well, I'm going to homeschool on a year-by-year basis. Or others have said, well, I'm going to homeschool at least to this point. Again, no judgments one way or the other. But for those of us who say, I'm going to homeschool to a certain point, or I can see the day that it could be that I would send them to a classroom school, it's possible they won't know what their peers know. Let me disabuse you of that fear. They could have gone to one school and they transfer to the other school and they won't know what that other school taught. This happens all the time. They'll learn, they'll catch it, but the best thing, and this is part of the homeschool adventure, they've learned at home how to ferret out the information for themselves. They've also found that education is interesting and fun. Let me tell you, my son, my eldest son, who just graduated from college a week ago, he didn't really learn to read until 6th, 7th grade. He really struggled with that. So Sarita would kind of read every other paragraph just to keep him moving through the books. He finally caught on. We recognized that was a great blessing of homeschooling because he did not suffer any of the ridicule that he would have absolutely suffered in any classroom school. He went off to a public high school, 9th grade. He didn't know anybody in that school. Immediately, though, he rose, boom, right to the top. The kids honored him, respected him. He was a leader. He graduated. He was a not a valedictorian, salutatorian in his school. He wouldn't have been there otherwise, but that he had enjoyed the homeschool opportunity with great literature. He'd learned how to ferret the information for himself. There are helps that will help you get everything you want out of a book. Our company offers instructor guides, which ask amazing questions. I had a sheet and I forgot to bring it. But here, just in the beginning of Johnny Tremaine, I was just looking at this a little earlier and just giving you some, hopefully give some idea of the kinds of things that you can pull out of books. If you'll just take the time. You can do this yourself, or you could allow somebody like Sunlight to provide some aids. Right at the beginning of the book, the Cox in Boston backyards had long been... Boston, where is Boston? A lot of kids won't know that, so you look it up on the map. You just determine we're going to use this as a jumping-off place to learn these things. Cats in malt houses, what's a malt house? What is it there for? Granaries, what's a granary? Hancock's Wharf on crowded Fish Street. Well, this is Boston. Let's see if that really exists. We can find out how to read a map, how to find things. Johnny was already in his leather breeches. What are breeches? What are leather breeches? Dove hated the way the younger apprentice lorded it over him. What's an apprentice? Now, I am really going to an extreme here, pulling stuff out. But you can, I mean, that apprentice thing alone, just the concept of it, you could push to some degree. I'm going to have to cut this short because I'm running out of time. I wanted you to enjoy a little experience of literature-rich education. And so I'm going to take a book that... one of my favorites. It's amazing because it's so simply written. The language in here is astonishing. Sarah Plain and Tall. Now, this isn't a historical novel. has no, as far as I know, no real historical value to it, but it's wonderful literature. And I'm going to ask you at the end, what is the value of reading a book like this as part of your educational program? The story is about a little boy and his older sister. They're in a farm somewhere on the plains of America, probably about 100 years ago. Caleb, the son or brother, asked, "Did Mama sing every day, every single day?" He sat close to the fire, his chin in his hand. It was dusk, and the dogs lay beside him on the warm hearthstones. "Every single day," I told him for the second time this week, for the 20th time this month, the 100th time this year, in the past few years. "And did Papa sing too?" "Yes, Papa sang too." "Well, Papa doesn't sing anymore," said Caleb very softly. A log broke apart and crackled in the fireplace. He looked up at me. "What did I look like when I was born?" "You didn't have any clothes on," I told him. "I know that," he said. "You looked like this." I held the bread dough up in a round, pale ball. "I had hair," said Caleb seriously. "Not enough to talk about," I said. "And she named me Caleb," he went on, filling in the old familiar story. "I would have named you Troublesome," I said, making Caleb smile. "And Mama handed me to you in the yellow blanket and said," he waited for me to finish the story, "and said," I sighed, "and Mama said, isn't he beautiful, Anna?" "And I was," Caleb finished. Caleb thought the story was over, and I didn't tell him what I had really thought. He was homely and plain, and he had a terrible holler and a horrid smell, but these were not the worst of him. Mama died the next morning. That was the worst thing about Caleb. "Isn't he beautiful, Anna?" Her last words to me, I had gone to bed thinking how wretched he looked, and I forgot to say goodnight to my mama. Okay, so Mama dies, and Dad has to find a wife. So he puts an ad in, and this woman comes, Sarah, plain and tall. That's the name of the story. And they've gone on for a while. In the morning, Sarah dressed in a pair of overalls and went to the barn to have an argument with Papa. She took apples for old Bess and Jack. "Women don't wear overalls," said Caleb, running along behind her like one of Sarah's chickens. "This woman does," Sarah said crisply. Papa stood by the fence. "I want to learn how to ride a horse," Sarah told him. "And then I want to learn how to drive the wagon by myself." Jack, that's the horse, leaned over and nipped at Sarah's overalls. She fed him an apple. Caleb and I stood behind Sarah. "I can ride a horse, I know," said Sarah. "I rode once when I was 12. I will ride Jack." Jack was Sarah's favorite. Papa shook his head. "Not Jack," he said. "Jack is sly." "I am sly, too," said Sarah stubbornly. Papa smiled. Yep, he said, nodding, "but not Jack." "Yes, Jack." Sarah's voice was very loud. "I can teach you how to drive a wagon. I have already taught you how to plow." "And then," she said, "I can go to town by myself."
"Say no, Papa," Caleb whispered beside me.
"That's a fair thing, Sarah," said Papa. "We'll practice." Well, she learns how to ride, and then Caleb got up and went over to the small barn window. I should mention, Sarah was from like East Coast, I think Maine or something, right on the coast. "What color is the sea when it storms?" Caleb asked Sarah. "Blue," said Sarah, brushing her wet hair back with her fingers, "and gray and green." Caleb nodded and smiled. "Look," he said to her, "look what is missing from your drawing." She had drawn a picture of her memory from Maine. Sarah went to stand between Caleb and Papa by the window. She looked a long time without speaking. Finally, she touched Papa's shoulder. "We have squalls in Maine, too," she said, "just like this. It'll be all right, Jacob." They had just survived a massive storm out on the plains. Papa kept his promise to Sarah. When the work was done, he took her out into the fields. Papa riding Jack, who was sly, and Sarah riding old Bess. Sarah was quick to learn. "Too quick," Caleb complained to me as we watched him from the fence. He thought a moment. "Maybe she'll fall off and have to stay here." "Why?" he asked, turning to me. "Why does she have to go away alone?" "Hush up, Caleb," I said crossly. "Hush up."
I could get sick and make her stay here, said Caleb. No. We could tie her up. No. And Caleb began to cry, and I took him inside the barn where we could both cry. Papa and Sarah came to hitch the horses to the wagon so Sarah could practice driving. Papa didn't see Caleb's tears, and he sent him with an axe to begin chopping up the tree by the pond for firewood. I stood and watched Sarah, the reins in her hands, Papa next to her in the wagon. So Sarah learns. The next morning, Sarah got up early and put on her blue dress. She took apples to the barn. She loaded a bundle of hay on the wagon for old Bess and Jack. She put on her yellow bonnet. Remember, Jack, said Papa, a strong hand. Yes, Jacob. Best to be home before dark, said Papa. Driving a wagon is hard if there's no full moon. Yes, Jacob. Sarah kissed us all, even my father, who looked surprised. Take care of Seal, she said to Caleb and me. That would be her dog. And with a whisper to old Bess and a stern word to Jack, Sarah climbed up in the wagon and drove away. Very good, murmured Papa as he watched. And after a while, he turned and went out into the fields. Caleb and I watched Sarah from the porch. Caleb took my hand and the dogs laid down beside us. Well, they're sure that she isn't coming back. But suddenly, right at dusk, dust, cried Caleb. He climbed the porch and stood on the roof. Dust in a yellow bonnet. Slowly, the wagon came around the windmill and the barn and the windbreak and into the yard, the dogs jumping happily beside it. Hush, dogs, said Sarah, and Nick leaped up into the wagon to sit by Sarah. Papa took the reins, and Sarah climbed down from the wagon. Caleb burst into tears. Seal was very worried, he cried. Sarah put her arms around him, and he wailed into her dress. And the house is too small, we thought, and I'm loud and pesky. Sarah looked at Papa and me over Caleb's head. We thought you might be thinking of leaving us, I told her, because you missed the sea. Sarah smiled. No, she said. I'll always miss my old home, but the truth of it is, I'd miss you more. Papa smiled at Sarah, then he bent quickly to unhitch the horses from the wagon. He led them to the barn for water. Sarah handed me a package. For Anna, she said, and Caleb. For all of us. The package was small, wrapped in brown paper with a rubber band around it. Very carefully, I unwrapped it, Caleb peering closely. Inside were three colored pencils. Blue, said Caleb slowly, and gray, and green. Sarah nodded. Suddenly, Caleb grinned. Papa, he called. Papa, come quickly. Sarah has brought the sea. Now, why would you ever want to read a book like that to your kids? I'm out of time. I'll tell you why. Why I'd want to read it, why my wife gave that book to me to read, because I'd burst into tears. Because it helps teach our kids character qualities. You can talk about that. You know, so many people, they want books that teach character to their kids. I didn't choose the better character book, 100 Dresses. These books bring real life home, and you get to teach your kids. Well, thank you for coming, and I appreciate your spending the time.